From Arezzo, Italy, I'm Suzette Gorlott, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. Rebecca Cruz and I discuss the new generation of Kosovar Albanians that are being recruited into extremist organizations like ISIS, and the massive sinkhole along the Arno River in Florence, Italy.
Perhaps it's not surprising that without the finances to up the infrastructure and to improve it, that these sorts of things are going to happen and we may not see the end of this.
Then I'll talk with United Nations Special Rapporteur on Contemporary Racism, Matuma Rutere. He argues one side effect of globalization is that it actually makes it easier to develop racist or xenophobic beliefs.
It's very possible to organize via social media, via the internet, and spread hateful, inciting messages as we are seeing now.
These conversations are coming up right after this hour's news. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlott. Rebecca Cruz, we're here in Italy, and so we have to talk very quickly about what we saw happen in Florence this week. This sinkhole that emerged along the Arno River near the old bridge, the Ponte Vecchio, big chunk of the side of the river that fell into the river due to a broken water pipe underneath the street, basically cars parked on top of it. We were just standing there the day before. It was very strange to see the news the next morning that this happened. But this raises all kinds of infrastructure issues in Italy. I mean, we've spent some time here. We see that they struggle a little bit to keep up with their roads, their bridges, with their piping. I mean, this is maybe a reflection of the financial problems that Italy suffers from.
Absolutely seems to be. I think the other thing is the number of tourists. We certainly saw that when we were in Florence the last couple of days. Massive numbers of tourists coming in, these large buses that are going over the roads, number of vehicles. We sat in traffic quite a bit. So perhaps it's not surprising that without the finances to up the infrastructure and to improve it, that these sorts of things are going to happen and we may not see the end of this.
Well, it is an old country and obviously has some old roads and clearly lots of tourists, but it's interesting to see something like that happen. It made international news the day after we were standing there along the river with a number of students. Well, let's stay in the region, at least move to southeastern Europe and talk a little bit about Kosovo. So it's been almost a generation since the NATO bombings in Kosovo. NATO bombed the area, claiming that Serbia was persecuting the Kosovar Albanian population. And this ultimately, of course, led to, many years later, Kosovar independence in 2008. So now Kosovo's back in the news. Very interesting information about the Kosovar Albanian youth, some youth, but some of their population being recruited into extremist organizations, lured into Syria to fight on behalf of ISIS. And so what is it that we're to think about this? I mean, Kosovo is such a pro-Western country, really, has been, I mean, obviously the United States and its NATO allies came to defend Kosovo. And they have statues and murals dedicated to Bill Clinton. They've named streets after him. So here we are with a new generation of young people in Kosovo looking to other parts of the world and to joining extremist groups. What do we think of this?
Well, as you say, a pro-Western country, but certainly one of the most pro-Western Muslim countries, so a number of Muslim youth. And some of the same reasons that we would expect, unemployment, corruption, the rule of law in Kosovo, even when it was an international protectorate, but certainly since they declared independence, has really been lacking. So criminal ideas have been able to surface, and we see networks, trafficking, for example, criminal organizations. But really, since the early 2000s, we also see the influx of kind of this more extreme Muslim churches, identities, clerics coming in, some of them sponsored from other countries. Some are saying that Saudi Arabia has given money to some of these clerics that are allowing for more extremist views. This wasn't necessarily geared towards ISIS when this first started, but that has created an atmosphere where ISIS has become appealing. And in fact, it now looks like, under some investigations, that the number of people that ISIS has been able to recruit is the highest per capita of all of Europe. So that's pretty significant. Over 300 people in the last 2 years, number of women as well as some children under 18.
Well, I have to ask, I wonder if this is really happening largely because of a lack of attention from the West, from the rest of Europe, the United States, in the decade, almost two decades since the bombing, since the NATO campaign, that there wasn't much attention being paid to this area. There's kind of left a vacuum for others to come in and fill it. And that, of course, would include extremists.
Well, it certainly could. And you remember, if you look at the map, this area, the former Yugoslavia, is really surrounded by the European Union. There's been other things going on. You've got Greece dealing with their issues. You've got Hungary dealing with those issues. And then, of course, all the immigrants that are coming through, and the migrants and the refugees. And so not a lot of attention paid here. Muslim country, other economic issues going on. In many ways, this isn't surprising, but no one has really been paying attention.
All right, we'll continue to watch that. Thank you so much, Rebecca, as always.
Thank you.
If you have any comments about this discussion, you can leave them in the Worldview section of KGOU.org. We also welcome your thoughts on Twitter. You'll find us at Worldviews KGOU, and you can follow me at Suzak Berlot. Next, I'll talk with Matuma Rutere. He's a top United Nations official who focuses on racism and xenophobia. We'll talk about how some of the work he's doing relates to Europe's migrant crisis. I'm Suzette Grelot, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelot. This week, government delegations gathered in Istanbul for the first ever United Nations World Humanitarian Summit. The goal is to overhaul how aid is delivered and make the world safer for refugees. The UN has called the current mass migration of people from the Middle East the worst humanitarian crisis since World War II. Joining me today to talk about some of these issues is Matuma Rutere. He's the UN Special Rapporteur on Contemporary Forms of Racism, Racial Discrimination, Xenophobia, and Related Intolerance. Matuma Rutere, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, I think most of us have a pretty good concept of racism and racial discrimination and the kinds of things you might be doing. But tell us more about the xenophobia part of what you're working on. I'm assuming that you're focused particularly on migrants, maybe people coming in and out of countries, and the concern and worry about those people coming in and out of the countries and discrimination that's related to them. Tell us about your job and what particularly the xenophobia part relates to.
Well, thank you. And I think that the question is timely because I'm at the moment working on a report for the Human Rights Council on the question of xenophobia. And you are right, this is one of the concepts that are not very clear. And this is the first time we're actually doing a comprehensive report, global report on the question of xenophobia. And there's a close relationship, a lot of intersectionality with racism and racial discrimination. But for most people, the dictionary definition of xenophobia, of course, has to do with the fear and, you know, the kind of hostility against migrants or people who are foreign. They could be refugees. Basically, people who are considered outsiders. And in our case, we are looking at how this form of hostility, discrimination, violence against such individuals is also linked to questions of race, nationality, and ethnic descent, because you'll find that in many cases, the individual is a subject of xenophobic discrimination, most likely someone who comes from a different country, from the host country. They could be people of a different race, ethnicity, or nationality. So this is particularly important now with the large movements of populations that we are witnessing globally. In many parts of the world, we've seen organized hostility, violence, incitement to violence against migrants, refugees, asylum seekers. We've seen countries proposing and actually building wars to keep out outsiders. We've seen mainstream political leaders inciting and organizing against outsiders, blaming migrants, refugees, asylum seekers for taking away jobs and committing crimes in the host country. So there's a new and urgent need to focus on this particular phenomenon, and also particularly remembering that the current system of international human rights protection was largely influenced by the events that were happening in Europe during the Second World War, and that was about concern for people who are refugees, people who had no other form of protection except the protection of international human rights.
Well, you mentioned that this is a timely subject, and obviously we're aware of the kind of global migration of peoples today and how this discrimination and obviously xenophobia is relevant. But of course, discrimination and xenophobia are not new concepts, and so there's... How would you compare it? I mean, what you see today, the kind of violence, the kind of xenophobic discrimination that you're referring to, how is it different today than what we might have seen? You referred to World War II, for example, during that era, or even, you know, many millennia or centuries before that. How would you distinguish it?
I think you're right. This is a problem we've had for quite some time, but I think what gives it particular urgency at the moment is the fact that we've largely become an integrated and very much interconnected world. Previously, 50 years ago, people took a very long time to travel from one country to the other. People didn't know much about what is happening in other countries, did not have the means of technology to organize even strangers to go and attack foreigners or migrants or refugees. Now we have a very interconnected system of communication and transport. People can very easily get into planes or find their way into other countries using roads and oceans. And of course, it's still very dangerous, but it's quicker, it's faster. People also get to know about other places where it might be safer. They wouldn't have known about that probably 50 years ago. And within countries where they might be subjected to xenophobic discrimination or violence, of course, we didn't have the instant forms of communication like we have at the moment, where it's very possible to organize via social media, via the internet, and spread hateful, inciting messages as we are seeing now. And of course, we were more hopeful 50 years ago. Of course, it was a bad time, but we were building an international system of protection. It is more tragic now and more urgent to focus on this because we, in spite of this great system, mechanisms, infrastructure of international human rights protection, we are witnessing and we are hearing the kind of aggressive rhetoric that was there 50 years ago, in 1930s, that should not be there, given what we know.
Well, you mentioned this international system of protection. What does that consist of? What do we have in place globally to protect migrants or people from different places from this xenophobic or even locals that are perhaps have been around for a long time, but to protect them from racial and other discrimination?
Well, globally, we have a very elaborate system of international treaties, the convention, the 1951 Convention on Protection of Refugees. Subsequent to that, we have a series of international human rights treaties, Convention on Elimination of Racial Discrimination in 1965, several other conventions and treaties that most states in the world have signed up to, have committed themselves to protection of the human rights of individuals who might be fleeing their countries for whatever reason. We have a system of assistance to the United Nations. And even domestically, you'll find that in most countries in the world now, unlike in the 1950s, we have domestic pieces of legislation that actually protect the rights of all individuals, irrespective of their nationality. So domestically and globally, we know more. We have made more commitments. We have put in place more laws and institutions to protect strangers who might be in need of assistance. And yet we see this continuing discrimination.
My guest is Mutuma Rutere. He's a senior United Nations official who focuses on issues related to xenophobia and racial intolerance. More of our conversation after a break. I'm Suzette Gorlot, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. My guest this half hour is Mutuma Rutere. He focuses on racism and xenophobia as a United Nations Special Rapporteur. When we left off, he described several international human rights treaties designed to curtail racial discrimination.
So we have this a number of, as you're saying, instruments and treaties and agreements. So what we're lacking is implementation and acceptance of these treaties at a local level and, you know, abiding by these laws. I mean, it's a matter of compliance. It's a matter of enforcement.
It is a matter of implementation. We've done very well in building these treaties, this system, but keeping to what the obligations is the challenge, is the implementation. And the problem of that implementation is because a lot of the implementation depends on politics, and sometimes politics gets in the way. States have to balance the interests of various domestic constituencies. States have to balance interests at the competing interests at the international level. And that is what weakens the system of implementation. So it is something that requires tending every day. It is certainly not a perfect system. It has many imperfections, but we don't have any other. We would be doing worse than we were if we did not have that imperfect system. And I think the challenge of the 21st century is to see where to improve that system, is to see what needs to be done, because we don't have any other alternative.
Well, it's an excellent point to say that, imperfect as it may be, this is the only system we have. Well, I want to shift very quickly to the work that you've done in Kenya. And in particular, you've written quite a bit, and you've worked obviously a lot in Kenya on police activities and particularly the use of torture and extrajudicial killings in Kenya by the police force. And so you've been working on ways in which, and studying ways in which, they are trying to professionalize their police forces and create a community police force that's serving its population as opposed to the state or politics or whatever it may be. Can you tell us a little bit about that work and how well you think Kenya is making progress in this area?
Well, thank you very much. Kenya has had, and in this respect, now I'm speaking in my capacity as a researcher based in Kenya, not wearing my UN hat. It has a long history of very poor record in terms of the police and protections of rights. And in the last couple of years, what we've been trying to work on is to improve that record of police in terms of professionalizing. We have in place now new laws provide for the independence of the police and the Inspector General of Police, that is the head of police. The reason for that is because previously the police would be misused for political reasons against political opponents. We also have in place a civilian oversight mechanism. This is an institution that provides oversight over police with regard to violations or accusations of violations. They can go in, investigate, recommend prosecution or recommend whatever forms of sanction against the police. In place now, we're trying to promote the need for a more professional recruitment training of police services. Of course, the greatest problem is to change the culture of policing, because ultimately the law is as good as the culture and the thinking of the leadership of the police service. That presents the challenges. We have what I would call is fairly good training. The challenge begins when police officers go on the streets, and that changes. And the problem is that the new training or the new influence they get from the veterans is that this is a different ballgame. You've got to kill the criminals before they kill you. Sometimes the language, in my experience, what I found is that sometimes the language of human rights may not be very successful in convincing the police to change the way they do their work. But the language of professionalism is one that provides a very good way of holding discussions, that if you don't build stronger partnership with the community, if you choose to use force unnecessarily, then you destroy the professionalism of the police services.
So Kenya obviously isn't the only country in the world that struggles with these issues. I would say elsewhere in Africa, certainly in places in the Balkans where I've done my work, in the Middle East, in Latin America. I mean, we could just go on and on, even locations in the United States, right? We have these issues. What is it that you think, again, the cultural issue is clear, but what can we do in terms of international institutions using international instruments to help facilitate this type of issue and create better police procedures?
I think one of the very key areas that I think can make a difference is establishing a very good oversight, either whether it's at the federal level, if you have a federal system, at the national level, if you have a provincial devolved system of government. An institution that provides a certain form of guidance, a certain forms of oversight over police at local levels. Now, of course, our policing is local, but in terms of standard setting, in terms of ensuring that they are adhering to human rights principles, the role of national governments at the national level becomes very important. In the case of the U.S., the Office of the Attorney General and the guidance to police is absolutely very important. And I have an occasion actually to use the example of the United States with regard to what the Attorney General has been doing as very good practice in terms of working with local police jurisdictions to improve how they do policing. And there are good lessons globally, but also there's some very number of weaknesses. One of the weaknesses is that we don't collect good data and statistics with regard to policing. So when, for instance, the accusations that the police might be profiling individuals, we don't have very good data to decide otherwise. One of the things that is very important to do is actually collect ethnically disaggregated data.
All right. Well, Mutuma, thank you so much for being with us today. This is a very interesting conversation. Thank you for shedding light on it.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to my conversation with Mutuma Rutere. He's the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Contemporary Forms of Racism, Racial Discrimination, Xenophobia, and Related Intolerance. You can download this conversation and all of our past interviews from our website, kgou.org, or subscribe to our weekly podcast. Worldviews is a collaborative partnership between KGOU and the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Miranda Wilson handles the show's research, and Brian Hartzinski produces the show. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Berlot.